There will be spoilers ahead. Lots of spoilers, so be careful, won't you?
Sink me, I've come up with such a clever poem for you all. Now attend. They seek him here, they seek him there. Max Mike movies seek him everywhere. Is he in heaven? Is he in hell? That demmed elusive Bumpy Nell. Quite amusing. What?
No.
You see, it rhymes, and that makes it a poem. Surprise! It was actually me! I'm sure all our listeners were completely taken in by my clever disguise, foppish that I was. But in fact, I am one of your hosts for this week's entry in Cause I Wanna and You're Gonna Like It, 1934's The Scarlet Pimpernel. Which host am I? Why, I am the dashing Vicomte of St. Darmok and Gillard at Tanagra, Max Levine, and over there, indulging in snuff as usual, is your other host, his excessive flatulence, the Grand Panjandrum, Mike. Treat us to some gassy wisdom, Mike.
Shock and terror.
That's it, Lord of Birdemia.
Yeah.
But before we get our swashbuckling on, we've got to talk about last week's...
poll question.
Last week, you may remember, the Riddler had us both chained... No, not the Riddler, sorry. We wanted to know, what is the most accurate feeling science fiction movie you've seen? And you had thoughts. Regan McStravick said, would Idiocracy be considered a sci-fi movie? No. Now it would be considered a documentary.
Yikes.
There's definitely a rather disturbing amount of Starship Troopers that rings true right now. Not realism per se, but Heinlein's oft-imagined culture of hyper-militarism certainly feels more and more prescient. Yeah, I cannot argue with that. Brian Mundo says, oh dear, brace for a dreadful shock. The Fifth Element.
Oh, yeah, that feels real.
Yeah, very real. I mean, at least I hope the future is some crazy, campy, chaotic version of things with really cool, singing, fighting, sexy aliens.
Sure.
Yeah. Honestly, I would rather be driving a cheap cab in that world than what's going on now.
You may soon be doing so.
Yeah. Tyler Stewart says, 2001 A Space Odyssey. Okay. Blade Runner. And Soylent Green.
How is Soylent Green scientifically accurate? We're not eating people.
No, yep. Not that you know of.
Please.
Charles Forthyte says, Avatar! Just kidding. Thank you,
I will
Charles.
Hurt you. I have
a
nickname for you, and I know you hate it because you punched me in the eye once when I called you it. Do you want me to call you that again?
Don't you do it!
He did, too.
Gravity and The Martian. Okay, both had some science mistakes, but were overall very realistic. That's true. The Martian only had sort of one big one that I always knew, I thought of, but...
Yeah, I can sum up Gravity real quick. It went like this. Whoa! There, that's the whole movie. You don't have to see it.
You're welcome, Sandra. Nick Hoffman says, 2001 without a doubt. Interstellar as a close second. Really?
Well...
Interstellar with the magic... Well, we'll get to that. There's another point about Interstellar coming up.
All you need is love.
Da-da-da-da-da. Matthew Reisman says, Enemy of the State is barely sci-fi, especially not now, but all the speculative aspects have come true. It's only inaccurate in that it didn't predict as extreme a response as it could have. That is, unfortunately, very true. Thanks a lot, Matt.
Hey, he didn't make the movie. Thank you for your answer, Matt. Don't listen to Max, as usual.
And, of course, one of the major scientific accomplishments of this century, the creation of the Tatum, is brought to us. Richard Tatum says, Loopers, the one with the time travel. Almost hands down, much of the tech just looks so slapped on to tech from the present, and the projections of where things will likely go felt sadly on target. Yeah, you know, if you take out the time travel thing...
And we'd like to.
Yeah.
Time travel.
Time travel. Thank you, Richard. Dave says, swimming pools. Dave says, Dark Star. Oh, man. Remember that one?
With the beach ball?
Well, I don't know about the beach ball being so realistic, but the science on that ship was pretty believable.
Except it was like, this is our ship, i.e. somebody's bedroom.
Yeah. I always loved that you have to teach the bomb phenomenology.
Okay.
Byron Ho says, The Martian. Okay, we've had that one. Ursula Murray Husted,
as far as I know.
Husted. Has anyone said Soylent Green yet?
Strangely, yes.
Yes, they have. I think in the future, everyone will be Charlton Heston eating people.
He's so greasy.
And of course, from that science fiction dystopia, which no one's ever really seen, Canada.
Yeah.
Vince says, sadly, one of the most accurate sci-fi films is 1984, the 50s or 80s version.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. 2001 certainly feels more accurate than any other film. But Andromeda Strain is up there, as you noted, in this podcast. The Martian is really good as well, and the writer was open about a couple of things he exaggerated to add some drama. Oh, okay.
Like potatoes. You know,
many people... Yeah, well, also the fact that either you have the really thin atmosphere on Mars, or you can have big windstorms. You can't have both.
Well, you can have one.
Yes, once, yeah. I know many people think Interstellar is up there, but it falls very way short for me. The whole love is the fifth dimension or whatever ruined it for me.
I thought that was a rock group.
Yeah. What was that song, The Fifth Dimension? I can't remember they did.
Aquarius?
Like a one-hit wonder?
Yeah.
Oh, that's it. Age of Aquarius. Yeah. Yes.
And Let the Sun Shine In and blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. Let the sun shine in. Never mind. That's a different song.
That's Pebbles and Bam Bam.
It might be. Every episode has to have a reference to the Flintstones. You know that.
That is true.
Or Robot Monster.
Be-hee-ho-ho.
Be-hee-ha-ha.
Be-hee-ha-ha.
Yeah.
Oh,
I'm sorry that I have to correct you, but the correct pronunciation for Superstone's call is, in fact, be-hee-hee-ha-ha.
Oh, okay. I'm going to have to watch that episode
Who
again.
Cares?
I do, damn it. And, we have calling from the future, our favorite science babe, Doris Hempelmeyer.
Hello, Max Mike Movies. Hi, Max. This is Doris Hempelmeyer here. To answer your poll question, which just happens to be, what is the most accurate feeling science fiction movie you've seen? Well, the movie that you're reviewing today, that one is a pretty good answer. Andromeda Strain, because all the science and stuff, it does feel very realistic to me. But that one aside, I'm going to say Arrival. Because here they are trying to figure out how to communicate with these things. And boy, well, that's a job. I wouldn't want to try to have that job. I really like that movie. So that's the one that came to my mind, and that's the one I'm going with. I hope both of you have a wonderful week. I hear somebody, somebody's special day is this week. Anyway, have a wonderful week, and I'll see you later, Max. Bye.
Well, thank you, my little scientifically accurate spaceship of love.
Duh.
Yeah, Andromeda Strain, we just talked about. Arrival, yeah, I mean, in some ways it's really out there, but I thought it was completely believable.
The thing I liked best about Arrival, and this is something that does actually pop up in scientific studies, is the idea that learning another language can actually change your thought process because you're having to look at things in a different way than you are.
Yep.
I don't want to say program, totally that's not believable. Fair, but you've learned to do so. And by learning another language, you're learning another perspective. And they just take it to the extreme in The Arrival. But man, I really like that movie. That's a great movie.
Cool. Thank you, Doris. And of course, trim off to the Emerald Isle. Our fine son of Erin, Beelolading, Beelolading, Beelolading. I only can do that because he's not Irish.
I don't know. I'm not sure if it's true. I don't actually know. I should ask him.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, you ought to. But with that last name, that's not an Irish last name.
How would you know? Have you ever been to Irish? No, you haven't.
No, but I have been to Poland, and that's a Polish name.
Olading?
No, his real name.
Shh. His name is Bill Olading.
Sorry. All right. He says, TV report. Quote, the world was stunned today by the death of Diego Ricardo, the youngest person on the planet. Oh, I know where this is going. The youngest person on Earth was 18 years, 4 months, 20 days, 16 hours, and 8 minutes old.
Ooh.
The camera pans away from the TV reporter to a bodega shop full of people, all sad, some weeping. The camera follows one patron out while everyone else stays inside, glued to the television. Seconds later, the bodega explodes. The patron falls into a pile of rubbish to protect himself from the bombing. Car crash, glass shatters, people scatter. A woman runs out of the bodega, screaming and holding her arm in her hand. In a jarring flash to the film's title, white text against a black background. One of the best first scenes in cinematic history. It sets the tone for the entire film, which I find chilling and engrossing. This is Children of Men from 2006.
Never seen it.
Envisions a world in the near future where the entire human race inexplicably loses the ability to procreate.
Ooh.
Societies break down, wars rage, and humanity loses hope. We find ourselves in what used to be the UK, which has fallen into a totalitarian state. Refugees are brutalized, most people live in squalor and misery, and Theo, Clive Owen, in an amazing performance, tries to find hope. He encounters his ex-wife Jules, a fugitive, who has a surprising discovery.
She's a man! Actually,
Julianne Moore. The film really captures the pessimism of our current age and what is likely to come in the near future as climate change manifests. The film is richly layered, the world-building is excellent, the poverty juxtaposed against extreme wealth, the brutal, afraid security state and how it manifests, the refugee prison ghetto, the stolen moments of humanity and happiness among the misery, failure, and fear. So much is just hinted at. Nuclear war may have occurred. Other governments may have fallen. What is propaganda and what is truth is not clear, similar to our own age. It's a pessimistic film. I would not watch it while drinking. But it's an important one and should be required viewing for any film series on futurism sci-fi. An amazing work. Well, I'm depressed now.
It sounds like something you should watch while drinking, or maybe high or something, because yikes. Something.
Woof.
Have you seen it?
I've seen part of it. I watched a chunk, and I got too depressed.
Oh, dear. Okay. Yeah, so, well, thanks, Bill. We always like your essays, even if it's depressing.
Yeah. What about you? What's your most accurate feeling science fiction movie?
I mean, I'm going to have to go with Robot Monster. I mean, I think the future is going to hinge upon the billion bubble machine and a gorilla with a porthole on its head.
True. We will all have to remember what it is to be like the human.
And once again, if you have never seen Robot Monster, I highly recommend ignoring it utterly. It's actually very boring. And it's also one of those films, spoiler, where at the end it's like, it was all a dream.
Okay. Or was it?
No, it was. Well, I wish it was. I don't hate to say this. I shouldn't be like that, because Doris has often some very good insight, but she took my movies.
both Andromeda Strain and Arrival?
More Andromeda Strain than Arrival, but Arrival pretty much because of the way we react to a first encounter with aliens, which is don't move or we'll shoot. I mean, that's honestly, I don't care what government it is. That's what's going to happen if it ever happens.
Yeah.
Although the truth is out there somewhere. Let's just ask these three kids.
Scully.
They won't.
Mulder.
So, Chief.
McCloud.
So I think that Andromeda Strain is about as sciencey as you're going to get. And I think it is, as I said, almost a procedural more than a film. But we liked it. So, I'm going to go with Andromeda Strain. What about you?
Okay. I got to go with either War Games, although it's not too science fiction-y because pretty much we've surpassed it technologically by now.
I mean, Siri can do
that. But the one that gets me and always I thought was the most depressing was Gattaca.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah, that movie where basically everything is based on your genetic makeup.
Yeah.
They you know, when you apply for a job, they take DNA, they try to get DNA samples of you, and the whole idea is all the best people are now born in test tubes because they can edit out all of the negative traits and natural.
Let's go there and say they can edit out the non-whiteness because.
Yes. Yeah. Gattaca's a very white movie.
Yeah. When I was a kid, they didn't have a word for carpooling. We called it Gattaca. So. That's a
double
deeper...
up in the morning.
I didn't even remember that part. Anyway, so that's our answers. But thank you for yours.
Yeah, those were terrific. Thank you very much. And we want still more because we are a never-ending hunger for poll question answers.
Artax, no!
Feed our dark hunger, lest it wreak havoc upon the universe.
Just answer the
question. There's some havoc. Havoc for everybody. But we want to know, and this one is similar to some of the old ones, but... And I can't imagine where I got the idea. Who's your favorite swashbuckler from the movies?
Ah.
Is it the Scarlet Pumpernickel? No. Is it Zorro? We will tell you our secret identity hotline. I mean, our ways of answering at the end of the show. But now... the facts. Budget for the Scarlet Pimpernel. £81,000.
Oh, you actually found
it. Of bananas.
No.
Yeah, I couldn't find it in American dollars. I do convert it, though. So, budget was £81,000. Box office, £420,000.
Wow.
In today's money, the budget would have been about $10 million, and they would have made about $57
million. So, pretty successful, yeah.
This was a pretty darn successful movie.
Yeah.
Probably why it's been remade about six different times.
What?
Including a series. Oh, yeah. First off, this isn't the first creation of it. The first one was in 1917. This is a silent version.
Oh. Did they seek him there, seek him here? Did they seek him everywhere in 17?
I don't know. They couldn't hear.
Oh.
One in the 50s, one in the 80s, one in 99. Ian McKellen plays Chauvelin in one of them.
Oh, I didn't see that one.
Yeah. This was adapted from a play written by the Baroness Orze.
Oh.
A Hungarian noblewoman with her husband, Montague Barstow, who was the son of an English clergyman.
That's starting to make sense. Okay.
Yeah, she was a major aristophile. She
apparently
always believed in the... Yeah, she really liked the aristocracy. She didn't think much of the peasants.
We'll get back to that.
Or the peasants. Yeah. This story, however, is the one, and this is true, this is the first one that introduced the whole... hero with a secret identity trope into popular culture. This predates Zorro by 14 years.
I'm surprised it's that little. I would have thought it would have been a lot longer, but...
There were over a dozen sequels written by the Baroness about Sir Percy and the League of the Scarlet Pimpernel.
Oh, last right, one was written in... There's the one guy that drives the really long car. There's the one who turns into Mr. Hyde.
No. There's the Martian, and there's a guy with the ring that glows green.
No. There's Blue Beetle, and there's Booster Gold.
Oh, yeah. Right.
She created the Legion of Superheroes.
She did.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah, why not? She wrote over a dozen sequels about them. Last one was written in 1940.
Okay.
Now, when this was released, the Motion Picture Producers and Distributors of America looked at it and admonished, there is cleavage in reel one.
What?
There is cleavage in reel four.
What?
There is, this is the actual phrase, gross cleavage in reel eight. Adding that it was the last film it would pass containing scenes of offensive cleavage.
But of course, we must understand the proper pronunciation is clavage, because...
Clavage, yes.
Wow, yeah, I didn't even notice it until you mentioned that.
I know. Sir Percy Blakeney refers to one of the boxers as Mendoza. This is a reference not to the character on The Simpsons, Mendoza, but the 18th century British Jew who revolutionized boxing. Mendoza was the heavyweight champion of England from 1792 to 95, despite only being a middleweight.
Locksley Mendoza, man of a thousand voices.
When Percy recites his poem of the Scarlet Pimpernel,
which it
contains
time?
The word dimmed, which in the U.S. in 1934 would have been construed as profanity and would not have been allowed, but because it was produced in England, it was okay.
I see. So because it was in English, we got away with it.
Yep. Demmed? What does that mean?
Demmed.
The original copyright holder failed to renew the film's copyright, and this resulted in it falling into public domain.
Oh.
Meaning anybody could duplicate and sell a VHS or DVD copy of the film.
Just like Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah, a lot of versions of this film available on the market that are usually badly edited or often of terrible quality or duped from second or third generation copies of the film.
Max, I have a recommendation. Let's you and I get a copy of the film and redub the whole thing.
Okay.
Can you do your outrageous French accent? Because
French accent, you silly king.
That might be fun.
That filthy pimpernel. Chavonnière is everywhere.
Claude Dicat always gets his mouse.
Okay. He gets his pimpernel. While having her portrait painted, Lady Blakeney addresses the artist as Mr. Romney. This is probably George Romney, one of England's most highly regarded portrait artists of the 18th century.
Cool. Yeah. And had a marsh named after him and a scarecrow, too.
Yep. And a governor of Massachusetts. In the scene where Lady Blakeney asks for her husband's help to rescue her brother, and just before he leans on the fireplace, I was watching for this because I read a fly lands on his sleeve.
Yeah, I saw that too, and it just sits there.
Like, I remember thinking, is that like a problem in the film? No, that's a bug. Yeah. A bug with little wings.
Hoyle.
There is not much other trivia available about this film, unless you've got something.
No, I'm surprised you found as much as you did. I'm surprised you found the budget, never mind the take.
I had to do some digging for that one.
Yeah, well, our listeners appreciate... I'm sorry, our listener appreciates that. I know there's more than one.
Yes. And now it is time for...
Le ploté.
You know what? Le plot, as we say, or... Das Plot, they say in German.
No, they don't.
Yes, they do. It's hard out here for a procurer of delights in a city in North Carolina, but Percy does his best to provide fine ladies for...
North Carolina?
Oh, crap. I'm sorry. That's the porn parody, The Charlotte Pimp.
Oh, dear.
Don't know where my head's at. The year is 1792. Around tea time, the French Revolution has given way to the new French Republic... At a time of mass executions of French aristocrats and aristocratic sympathizers known as Le Terreur, which translates as Le Terror. Men, women, and children are being beheaded. Fear haunts the street. The price of Creplock is at an all-time high. Who will save us? By the Scarlet Pimpernel and his League of the Scarlet Pimpernel, of course. This mysterious rogue, master of disguise, and cunning planner of cunning plans uses trickery, misdirection, and just plain sneakiness to spirit French aristocrats out of the clutches of citizen Robespierre,
boo,
and his evil henchman, Ambassador Chauvelin, boo. While not out buckling swashes, the Pimpernel hides behind his secret identity of Sir Percy Dovetonsel, I mean Blakeney. Where he plays the role of an empty-headed, fashion-obsessed Instagram influence. I mean fop! Excuse me, fop. His wife, the lovely French actress Marguerite, is disgusted with her foppish husband and admires the courageous Scarlet Pimpernel, little suspecting. But soon, evil plots are afoot. Chauvelin blackmails Marguerite into helping him unmask the Pimpernel by kidnapping her brother Armand. It's up to Sir Percy to do some daring do that he do so well and save the day. Quick, to the Pimpmobile.
Down the pimp poles.
Yep.
Oh, wait, was that it? You're all done already? Oh, okay. We're not going to even talk about the ending. All right, well.
The film.
Scarlet Pimpernel. Had you'd seen this before, hadn't you?
I have, yeah. Oh, okay. A couple of times.
I thought that might be why you picked it. So back
I saw it in the theater when it came out.
Of course you did. You were only 12 at the time, but you found it a rousing good time.
Yep. That's right. I'm over 100 years old.
So I will say, I was surprised that there were at least a few people in here I'd actually heard of because, you know, being British and stuff. And starting off
with... I did not recognize it, but I knew to look for them. But let's start off with them. Leslie Howard.
Ashley Wilkes himself. Ooh.
Yep, from Gandhi with the Windy.
Yeah, a few years later, but...
Also, he was Professor Henry Higgins in one of the variations of Pygmalion.
Oh. Interesting.
Yeah.
I did not know where you had got the sink me thing from some of your role-playing in our past, but now I do.
This is exactly where, 100%.
I mean...
Sink me.
He plays the fop very well. He is very humorous.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things where the acting has yet to fully mature. And so the style of acting in this is not what we would think of as nuanced as it is now. Let's put it that way.
No, it's more a holdover still from the silent film era where everything was exaggerated because that was taken from the stage. I think he's really smooth at going back and forth between the Pimpernel and Percy.
Yeah, and we'll come back to that as far as the secret identity goes. He's funny. I got to say, though, I got tired of hearing that damn poem. It's like, really? Really? Yeah, and I didn't know where that came from either because I'd heard it before, but I didn't know it came from this movie. So,
yep.
Yeah, I mean, Leslie Howard's fine.
I think he's really good at this. He's absolutely convincing as a fop, but he's also fairly convincing as, you know, the tough guy.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Well, do-gooder. And then we got Merle Oberon. Well, oh, those eyes.
She's wow. One of those names of early cinema. She was very well regarded. I have to say, though, her first scene in this film made me go, I hope she gets better. And luckily she does.
She does.
First one's just kind of awkward. But later on, it's a problematic character. I don't think it's her. It's a problematic character who's like, oh, I meant to do the right thing, except that time I did the wrong thing, but I'll never do it again. Oh, except when I have to. So she's fine.
Yep. I will look at her eyes in anything. She's terrific.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's Dr. Gillespie. I mean, Raymond Massey, who plays Chauvelin.
He will eventually play a very well thought of version of Lincoln sometime in the 50s, yep. I think.
He also plays Jonathan Brewster in Arsenic and Old Lace.
Oh, okay.
I'm off to Panama.
I will have to say this. Chauvelin does not have a mustache to twirl, but he's damn close.
Yeah. And what the hell is his accent?
Oh, we'll come back now, to the accents.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. But at the end, I swear to God, he's almost like, bleh, I am the vampire Chauvelin, bleh.
The thing about a Chauvelin in this film is, for the most part, he actually seems to be the only one who's actually competent. Everyone around him seems to be a boob and a moron. And I mean that on both sides, but we'll come back to that. So, he's generally enjoyable to watch. He's wonderfully villainous. So, but
this is one of the only other roles we've ever seen Nigel Bruce in. All I could think of was that. All right, Your Highness, enough of your bumbling.
Yeah, quite honestly, and especially without his mustache, Nigel Bruce is the Prince of Wales. Apparently, this Hungarian aristocrat lady didn't think much of the British aristocracy because all he does is worry about his suits.
Well, that's not entirely off. I mean, the prince regent or whatever he was at that point, the crown prince. You notice we never see the king, and there's a reason for that. We'll get to that later.
Okay.
But I think he's there as a comic figure or a sort of jovial one.
I mean, he's Nigel Bruce. Let's face it. This is what he does.
He's being Nigel Bruce.
A little bit more than he does when he's playing Watson, but he is smile-inducing, and he is meant to be. So, you know, he's fine. I just kept looking like, why does he not have a mustache? That's just weird.
Yeah,
and why does he have this collar that he can't, like, he has to lift his chin to talk over? We'll get back to the clothes, though, because they're their own thing.
Oh, the clothes, yep. That's most of the major characters. There's a lot of and the rest.
Well, we have all these characters like Suzanne de Tournay, Countess de Tournay, Marissa de Tournay. We have Mel de Tournay. So, you know.
We have Rebecca Latournay.
So, you know, but I have to say, one of my first notes was, wow, there's a lot of people in the opening credits. There's like three screens of characters.
But
those are the ones that matter, really, honestly. Everyone is fine.
But the people who show up, even like, you know, Romney, the painter.
Yeah.
He's somebody. I can never remember who. Well, but I know for one thing, in the original Pride and Prejudice, the one with Laurence Olivier.
Mm-hmm.
I believe he's Mr. Collins.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
He is always, he's always tends to be these, you know, somewhat foppy. It's Melville Cooper is the guy's name for his sins.
I mean,
but he's also, that was it. He's the sheriff of Nottingham in the Errol Flynn Robin Hood.
Oh.
Yeah. Yep. He was also in Around the World in 80 Days, the 56 version. He's done a lot. There are a lot of, that guy. English performers in this.
Well, as you well know, it is British law that at any given time, there can only be 50 actors, and they all have to do everything, and every one of them, even if they're a comedian, has to be on a detective show. Just, that's the law.
It is Brit law.
It's true. Especially people, you're just like, really? They're a detective? Okay. But, so the cast is fine. I think we can move on from the cast.
Okay, let's talk about the accents.
Why accents?
My God, there are a lot of English people in France.
Oh, my God.
Everybody in France has an English, everyone in this movie has an English accent, which honestly I'm grateful for, because there is nothing more painful than listening to old style Brits doing what they think is a French accent.
Or any accent. I mean,
a lot of them. I mean, it really is the, I'm French. Why do you think I have this outrageous accent, you silly king?
Well, speaking
That's not an exaggeration.
I don't know if when we first see Chauvelin, quite honestly, my note was, why do I want Chauvelin to be played by Rowan Atkinson? Because I really do.
The Scarlet Pimpernel. Oh, God.
I know. Wouldn't that have been great?
That would have been terrific.
Except
he is supposed to be menacing.
Yes, and he was. And he is. Rowan Atkinson is, how shall we say, not.
Rowan Atkinson's great. He's not scary.
I didn't care for the fact that everyone had the same accent, although let's face it, it's not like we're not guilty of that too, because according to Americans, everybody speaks with a British accent no matter where you're from. Oh, we're going to do this film called How to Train Your Dragon, and it's going to be about Vikings. Well, they at least have Scottish accents. Well, one of them has a Scottish accent. Some of them have American accents, and then the rest of them don't even bother. So, ancient Rome, British. Anywhere British. So I get everybody's it, but there is a way you can tell the Brits and the French apart. I don't know if you know, it's very subtle, but the Brits how shall we put this? All good looking, and all the French folks are ugly.
Kind of weird. Well, not the aristocrats. The French aristocrats, a lot of them, especially the women, are very good looking. Come on. Yes, Suzanne's gorgeous.
Well, but then Lady Blakeney doesn't count because now she's a British person.
Well, she's French. Yeah, that's true. Then she's
if you
converted.
Say so, because there's no way I would
she's
know.
She's totally French. She's totally French. We. You can tell by the... Anyway.
Mais oui, Josephine, I'm as sane as you. But
as you are.
Yeah, I just thought it was very interesting and very telling that as soon as we get to see the French peasants, they are all wicked dirty and wicked ugly, like on purpose.
Also, they're all horrible. They're all nasty and mean. This is very pro-aristocracy. They throw in a couple of vague lines about, I'm French. Perhaps we should have thought more about how he treated our French peasants here in France. And that's it. Then we never address it again.
Do you want to talk about that
now? It doesn't matter that they were...
I guess you do. I was going to wait till later to talk about this part.
Nope, let's do it. Come on, let's address the elephant in the room.
Apparently the film did very well. I'm guessing in Britain, because that's where it was made. It certainly wasn't made in France. I'm betting it wouldn't have gone over very well in France.
Oh, it did not. It is very hard to deal with from a modern perspective, even not that modern. I mean, first off, the Republic, the democracy are the bad guys in this.
Yeah.
And aren't all of these nice aristos, so put upon? Now, to be fair, the terror was horrible.
Yes, it was.
It was a terrible time. It lasted over a year, maybe a year and a half. And they were killing men, women, and children.
Yes.
They were killing people who had sold food to the aristocrats. They were killing people who had ever been nice to the aristocrats. And they were killing, 8-year-old children who happened to be aristocrats. The aristocrats had had centuries of treating the poor like absolute crap.
Yep.
And Louis XVI, well, let's just say he didn't make it any better at all.
Apparently he was somewhat, shall we say, indecisive. I did a little reading on the French Revolution before I came here, because I'm like, all right, I know there was a reason for this. Oh, yeah, that's a good... Oh, that... Yeah, that's a long time. Yeah. Oh, wow, that's... Okay, so I'm on the side of the peasants. Of course, if you try to watch this film today, I don't know about you, because, you've seen it before. I hadn't. And the only thing I know about the Scarlet Pimpernel is a Daffy Duck cartoon called The Scarlet Pumpernickel, which, quite honestly, isn't all that different except for the marriage part. The price of Kraplock did, in fact, skyrocket. The dam doesn't break, though.
The dam does not break.
But I'm sitting there watching this going... why am I supposed to be sympathizing with the aristocracy? Why is the Scarlet Pimpernel in any way a sympathetic character? Why am I on his side? This makes no sense to me. And then when I looked up stuff on the French Revolution, just briefly from Wikipedia, I'm just like, how did this get made? Like, how were there not revolts and people throwing stones at stuff? Because this is saying rich people good, poor people bad. I mean, that's really what this is coming out and saying.
You also have to remember what was going on historically. 1934, we were in the middle of the Depression, and so was Europe. This was the time when they liked spectacles. They liked big, impressive movies, and they liked watching rich people. Because it was a fantasy.
I guess.
So the rich people, you know, you looked at the Fred Astaire movies and all the big musicals with people in tuxedos and ball gowns.
Drinking.
Drinking. Oh, so much
Nick
drinking.
And Nora. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess I just was like, because the film is so politically based, I'm just like, wow. How is this?
It's very oversimplified.
Oh, you ain't kidding.
It's very much like, here are the good guys, here are the bad guys. It's also, from an American perspective, it's kind of weird. Because they're talking about good King George. This is George III, Fat George, the guy we revolted against.
Yeah,
The guy who tried to crush our country. And you know why we don't see him in 1793? Because at this point, he's kind of started to go,
Yeah, there's a whole background of that. One of the classes I took in American history once, she explained what was potentially going on with him and how it actually might have been caused by a disease. Really interesting.
I think it was porphyria. Yeah,
yeah, and apparently part of the reason that the revolt happened was because we had said, the heck with kings, and the American Revolution was in some ways influential on the peasants in France, and that was part of why they went crazy. I think over at our shores, we're like, we didn't go that crazy. Oh, man, these French people
guys,
are testy.
Jeez, man!
But
Tone it down!
I'm just watching this going, yeah, Percy Dove tonsils, but he's kind of a jerk, and although, to be fair, the way they portray the French jail in this doesn't look all that bad. The kids are jumping and playing games and laughing and having fun. And there's nice men sitting down playing chess. And it's like, it all seems very convivial, really quite nice.
Sure, because they had money to bribe the guards. They would get privileges.
I think it was the depiction that may have been off. I don't think...
Very likely. I mean, these guys were being shoved in the Bastille. It wasn't a very nice place.
So,
especially, because a lot of the peasants there were like, hi, we were locked up here. Guess what?
Yeah. Let's see how you like it. I don't think there was a lot of kids playing games. And everyone's so well-fed and clean. It's nice.
Yeah.
So, I have to say, when we get to the end of the show, that's going to cloud my judgment, because I'm not on the Pimpernel side. I'm not on the side of Chauvelin either, but if I had to pick one of the two, I'd kind of go with the pro-democratic folks. I don't think I would go with the nasty aristocrats. So.
Sure, we're seeing it through a modern lens.
Well,
if you look at it just at the movie as a standalone, think of that. I mean, what do you think of the costumes?
Oh, dear God. I have this feeling that the costumes are very period accurate, but they're absolutely nuts.
They are. I mean, you look at that stuff, you realize, it's like, all right, I have to go change. I'll be back in 4.5 hours.
Well, there's that one point where it's literally Sir Percy Dove Tonsils talking to Chauvelin going, oh, let me show you how to tie a cravat. It's actually the Prince of Wales. Oh, no, let me fix it. The cuff.
The sleeves are a disgrace.
And you're looking at all these guys, and they're trying to be like sort of like tough Republican, or not Republican, but tough political guys, and I'm just looking at them go, I'm sorry, I am this close to just breaking out laughing because of what you're wearing. It's crazy.
The idea is they were playing the part. This was a thing at the time, the dandy or the aficionado. That was a particular look. They were insanely obsessed with clothing. Everything had to be just so, the little birthmark sometime. And you can argue that these guys were playing, some of them anyway, were playing a part. They were pretending to be dandies to show that, no, we aren't going off and doing no daring do.
Yeah, but I look at people like Percy Blakeney, and I'm like, how did they have any kids? Because that guy's never, ever going to man up and do his duty.
Well, you notice they don't have any kids. But at the end, Then she's like, oh, yes, my man!
Yeah, which is fine.
When she finds out that he's the Scarlet Pimpernel, and they find out why there's this tension between the two of them.
Right.
Because he's never forgiven her because she turned over an aristocrat to the Republic.
Right.
And as it turns out, you know, he had destroyed her life. He threw her in prison. And she didn't even do it directly. She complained to some friend of hers who told someone else who told Robespierre.
No, her friend was Chauvelin. That's who she told.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
I'm sitting there going, okay, you look at Chauvelin. You didn't figure out that he might not be a good guy. Okay.
Yeah. He has villain stamp. He really should have like a snidely whiplash mustache, like you say.
I'm not going to blame you for that. You were too dumb to not see that Chauvelin was a bad guy. Yeah, I'm going to blame you for that. Yeah.
I'm not evil. I'm just French.
Yeah, well, he was not. He was not French at all. So, yeah, the clothes, though, I kind of want a jacket with one of those tall collars. I don't know why. I just kind of do.
That looks so impractical. Well, you can't see anything to the left or the right. You can barely turn your head.
I know.
That thing that the prince had coming up the front of his collar. It was like, I see, you know, if you nod your head too suddenly, you'll cut your own throat.
Well, you know, maybe that was just very prescient. And that's sort of the beginnings of the masks we'd use for COVID.
Ah, that's it.
You don't need a mask. I just lower my head, you see, like, and now I'm totally protected. So, yeah.
One thing that surprises me about this movie, because I remember it being recommended to me among other swashbuckling movies. The Arrow, the Seahawk, Captain Blood. There's no fighting in this.
Not really, and there's no swashbuckling.
No, there's no swashbuckling. The Scarlet Pimpernel does everything by cunning. He outmaneuvers and outplans people.
What?
And uses his incredible disguises. I still love him as the old woman, where all I could think was, that's not even your proper nose. It's made of polystyrene.
Well, and he's taking off the nose, and all I can think of is, oh, it's going to be Basil Rathbone underneath. I just know it. I'm fine with his disguises until the end of the film, and his last disguise is, I put on a hat. That's it? Yeah. It's literally just...
Well, there he's not trying to hide. He knows he's there to confront Chauvelin.
Well, except he isn't, because he doesn't know Chauvelin's going to be there. And I'm going to come back to that part.
True.
He's just in a soldier's outfit, but he's literally... The only thing that could keep you from not knowing he's Percy Dovetonsils is he's wearing a hat. That's it.
Oh, you mean when he's in like...
In the boat.
Hanging out in the square. Oh, okay.
In the boat at the end. Yeah. I will say that at the beginning, there was that nice twist where we see... whoever he is, because we don't know he's the Pimpernel yet. We know he's the Pimpernel. And he's the old lady in the carriage, and they're going off. And then suddenly there's some guards. I wasn't taken in. I actually was like, I bet they're on the same side. But I did like that little twist. I thought that was kind of neat, even if I didn't fall for it. So
that was a nice touch.
Yeah. The thing I have against it, as far as, you know, him being the Pimpernel and saving people, is we only see him do it once. And then there's all this...
hear him. Well, he does save her brother. We don't ever see it, but we know he did.
Well, he was in the process of doing it when he, at the end of the film. But, like, he's supposedly here and there and everywhere, and mostly we just see him in court. Sometimes in overly long party scenes, unfortunately. And they commit a sin that one should never commit in films, especially if they are British and are, how we say, languidly paced. Never, ever... zoom in on characters sleeping, because it just reminds the audience of how slowly this particular part of the film is going. I will say, though, for the languid pace, the scenes themselves in general don't tend to be very long.
No, I think the pacing is pretty good. It's not a long movie. It's 97 minutes.
No, but it doesn't go by quickly either.
No, it's leisurely. It's a 1934 movie. They were not fast-paced.
I will say this, too. We did a long time ago an episode on Dracula, and we did three different versions. We rewatched the 1931 version, and both of us came away saying, yeah, film hasn't really developed its language yet. It's really more or less a camera aimed at a stage play, which Dracula had been. This is three years later. And I got to say...
it's also a stage play.
Yeah, but I got to say, the camera language in this movie is a lot more developed than it was in Dracula.
I agree. You get more... The shots in... when they're in Paris, also known as Le Bac Lot.
Le Lot du Bac.
Le Lot du Bac, excuse me. And they're shooting from above. They're shooting from the rooftops.
Yeah.
And they're shooting through the streets. That's actually pretty advanced for the time.
It is, but it's weird. Because I know how they did it. They did one of two things. They either had a miniature, which so that basically anything above the first story was not there. And they hang them. They literally hang the miniature in front of the camera. And the camera is able to focus on both the miniature and the backlot at the same time, or it was a glass painting shot. But if you looked at the architecture above the first story, it's like, oh, apparently Dr. Seuss is making books already. It's really weird. Like,
it's very strange. The angles are all off just a little bit.
Well, things are kind of twisty and just, it was just, I mean, you know, nice try, but weird. So
I still like at the end, they're going back to England. We're home. It's like everything is, and I have in my notes, like, and everything is all right forever.
Rich they people and kind poor of people hint, get along. And-
No, they do kind of hint when they're hanging right before the final sequence, when they're all disguised as soldiers and they're talking to the old uncle in the square. And he's saying, oh, you think there'll be war with England? Oh, of course. I'm like, uh-oh. Well, yeah, not for another few years, but then, yeah, it's going to get bad because they're going to bring in this weird-ass general from Corsica named Napoleon Bonaparte, and things are going to get ugly around 1803.
Nope, don't remember him.
Yeah, so I think he was some minor guy.
Doesn't he mostly go east? Because once he goes west, that's where things go bad.
No, it's when he goes east that things get... Oh, for the English, it's bad when he goes west, but no, when he goes east, and as Eddie Izzard, or Susie Izzard says, you know, yeah, sir, we're going to invade Russia, we're going to go, oh, it's a bit cold, let's go home.
Everyone says that. Well, eventually.
Yeah. Yes.
Just leave them alone. Just don't. Yeah. But there was a quote in here that reminded me of a Monty Python bit, and there's a lot of little Percy quotes in here, but this one was, there's nothing so bad as something that's not so bad. Oh, it was one of Wilde's.
it does sound a little wildish, and I did like the little bits of, you know, who, sir? Me, sir? You, sir? Yes, sir. There's a little bit of the pellet with the poisons in the vessel with the pestle with Lord Winterbottom.
Well, that was one of my other quotes. Well, sink me if it isn't Colonel Ramsbottom. Oh. Winterbottom! Dude, change your name. Get the bottom out. Does not matter.
Yeah, seriously. No. Just Winter. Just call yourself Winter. Come on, dude.
It's like folks who still have the last name Butts, and it's like, just do your family a favor. Yeah. I know it may go back hundreds of years. Just change it. Ramsbottom, really? Winterbottom, what's the difference? You know, so.
We can sell anything.
Yeah.
I'm just about out, but what else you got?
I have one other question for you.
Yeah.
How does Chauvelin figure out that Percy is the Scarlet Pimpernel?
Scene missing.
It's funny because I was just re-listening to our episode on Sanshiro Sugata, which was a film just filled with scene missing.
Yeah, I don't know. I was trying to watch for that, and I'm not sure how he figured it out because she seemed to think it was Sir Andrew.
Yeah.
He was the one she thought she was betraying, but nope, apparently he just, I don't know, figured it out from, maybe he saw the painting too. I have to say, I like that scene where she finally figures out.
Yeah.
He doesn't tell her. She figures out that he's the Pimpernel because she's looking at this huge portrait and she notices that his ancestor is wearing the Pimpernel sigil on his ring.
Right.
It's not an obvious detail, but she catches it.
Well, but then right after that, it's, oh, I love my husband now. And she finds out that Chauvelin is like, ha ha ha, I'm going to get that rotten Pimpernel. I am going to set a trap for him. And I'm just like, how does he know? There's nothing in the film to suggest suspected him when he was sleeping on the couch. Every time he looked over, he was like, this guy, whatever.
I like that sequence. He's waiting for, the Pimpernel's going to be here at 10.
And no,
the
midnight.
Only one in the library. Oh, midnight. And the only one on the in there is Percy, passed out on the couch.
Yeah.
And he looks, and you can see him going, well, maybe, oh, please, not him.
Henry, the mild-mannered janitor, it can't be him.
Could be. I got to say, that was the point where I thought Raymond Massey did a really nice job because he does it all with his face.
Well,
it's all facial expressions.
Yes, but all he does is open an eye, grin, and then close the eye again and almost go, honk shoo, honk shoo, honk shoo.
That's Leslie Howard.
Oh,
Chauvelin. It looks over, and you could just see the thought process going on in his head. It's like, maybe it's... Nah, couldn't be.
But what
no.
if... No. No, 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 no,
no. No, 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 no.
Yeah.
You can just tell. And that just... you silly fop.
One last question before we get to the end.
Yeah.
At the end, when we've got the Le Trappé, and we've got Chauvelin in the little Golden Lion Inn, and we've got Percy coming, and there's no way to warn him, my Percy, my Percy. And eventually Percy does come in, and it's like, aha, I knew you were going to be here. No, you did not know I was going to be here. Yes, I did know. In fact, I knew so much
knew
that
you knew I
the shooting, the guards de shooting are outside, and I will have them shoot at you, and that will be the end of the Pimpernel. Ha ha! Oh, please, let my wife go. If you let her go, I will walk directly into the bullets. Did you buy it?
Nope. No, he knew already. He was like, oh no, I already know I've taken out your guys.
Yeah. And I've replaced them with my guys.
Yep, my guys are just waiting around the corner. Yep.
Yeah, I didn't fall for it either. And I didn't know about the how many sequels? 12?
No, in the books, yeah. Not the movies. There's only a couple of movies. There's Return of the Scarlet Pimpernel.
Yeah.
A couple of times. What I want to know is, Scarlet Pimpernel why doesn't he...
strikes back, yeah.
Yep, and the Scarlet Pimpernel goes to Hawaii, yeah. Why doesn't he just kill Chauvelin?
I don't know. It was one of my notes, too. Cellar with you. I shall put you in this pit.
I will put you into this easily escapable cellar and walk away.
What?
No, no! You don't!
Like, you know what's going to happen if he gets out. Yeah. Your cover's blown. So there's that.
Yeah.
So there's...
We
know there are French spies in England, so you're not going to last the next fortnight,
pal. He's going to get assassinated. Yeah, that's the thing. And you can't be the Pimpernel anymore. More like you say, your secret identity is blown. By the way, do you notice Sir Percy has an Alfred Brinker, the butler?
Yeah, okay.
Who clearly knows, but all I could think of is, Alfred, quickly!
And I'm sure it has to do with the morals and stuff at the time. Oh, we can't show our hero killing. It's like, but you would have shown the villain killing someone else and they're beheading people.
Because that's the bad guy. The good guy can't kill the bad guy in cold blood. I think that was actually part of the motion picture code.
I got to go with dumb. I'm sorry. Yeah. It's just, I mean, the maybe Hays it's not code. Historical. Well, there's no Pimpernel. That was all made up. So
yeah.
I just was like, yeah, you should have killed him. But you know what you shouldn't kill? And that is the end of the show where we decide...
Sure.
Play the music.
The finish.
So, Max.
Yes.
You've seen this before.
I did that thing.
Have you seen it many times?
I've seen it a couple of times, okay. I'd say. But I haven't seen it for a while.
So, and now you're looking
at... I was going to hold up.
Yeah, and you're looking at it critically for the show. I always watch movies differently for the show than I do otherwise.
Sure.
One of the main things is I pay attention.
Yeah, I usually take notes for most movies. Yeah.
What do you have to say about Le Pimpernel de Scarlet?
I think it's fun. I mean, it is historic nonsense, and it is very problematic politically and historically. But I think I really like watching Leslie Howard as Sir Batman. I mean, come on.
Millionaire, he did go to Londinium that time.
He did.
God.
It is such a model for Bruce Wayne.
Yeah, it's true.
Because he, in a lot of the versions of Batman, he plays him as this empty-headed millionaire playboy, Bruce Wayne.
Well, remember that serial where he's like, oh, I'm feeling so tired, I have to lay down.
Exactly. Yes, he was. You can tell he's doing Sir Percy Dove Tonsils right there. I mean, you know, Kid Pimpernel there with him. Well, that's all you would have needed. I think it's fun. I recognize it as a thing of its time. A lot of it doesn't age well. And again, they are still figuring out the film language. I enjoy it, and it's fun historically, and it is fun as an antecedent for so many others. What about you? You've never seen this before. You didn't even know it existed.
I mean, I knew there had to have been a film called The Scarlet Pimpernel because of Daffy Duck. I learned all my history through Warner Brothers or the Flintstones.
Warner Brothers
Gilligan's
taught us
Island.
So much.
Hey, you know, it doesn't matter where you get your information as long as it's accurate.
Nope.
So,
yep.
And the Scarlet Pumpernickel is actually pretty close to this, except for the marriage. That's what we got. I can see why it would be fun. I just kind of can't get past the political ramifications, which is it comes down to rich people good, poor people bad. And I just, especially in this day and age, I can't really excuse that. I just like, what tone deaf idiot wrote this? Like, seriously. Like, if you want to see this, you better be a rich person and not invite any of your lesser rich friends or poor friends. Because, man, this is, yeah, maybe, I get it.
Maybe. I think it's a fantasy.
Oh, I'll say. I just, I can't, especially in today's political climate, I can't get past that. I can't really root for the Scarlet Pimpernel now because he's kind of saving people from their just desserts. Yes, they should not have been beheading children. Oh, dear gods. But these are people that had gone through hundreds of years of horrible treatment. And I don't know. It just made me uncomfortable. I get it. I do get it, but I can't say that it's a bad film. I think that it goes out to do a certain thing and it does it pretty well. I just can't recommend it because of the really tone deafness of it in today's society.
Okay, I get that. That's reasonable. I can get past that, but I do understand it.
Yeah.
But what I do understand is that we have another poll question, and that is, who's your favorite cinematic swashbuckler? Maybe not the Pimpernel. He doesn't buckle a lot of swashes in this, but I don't know. Zorro, Captain Blood, Howard the Duck. I don't know. Somebody.
Howard the Duck?
Could be Howard the Duck. And you can tell us by emailing us at us@maxmikemovies.com. We love getting your emails. You can also visit us at our website, coincidentally also maxmikemovies.com, and leave a com. And
you've done that.
See what I did there?
Four times.
You can also go to social mediocrity.
Facebook, Blueski, and Mastodon. Keep going.
What?
Nope.
And of course, we're on every podcast app throughout time, space, and all possible relative dimensions. And you can call us with your voice. Did you know that your cell phone can be used to make calls? It can. You can call our hotline.
No, but I use mine
and
for it.
Leave us a voicemail. Really, it still works. I know many of you have never used this, but you can call us at 617-398-7266. That number, again, 617-398-7266. I know most of our listeners aren't so young that they forget that they can actually use the phone to call, but allow me my dreams. But we are about halfway through our fantastical series, 'cause I wanna. So, Mike, what? Stop doing that with your nose. I can see you. What
they can't
do you want to see? Oh, yes, I'm recording my screen and I'm going to post it.
Uh-huh.
But do you want to have us see next week?
Well, as we usually do with these series, we make up a list ahead of time of not the exact films we're going to do, but usually choices that we might make from a list. And I've decided to ignore that.
You monster!
Yeah,
you will throw us all into anarchy.
Well, the whole point of this series is to do films that we want to discuss, or potentially want to see, because maybe we haven't. And there is a film, and it's actually a very recent film, that I want to see, and I keep meaning to see, and I haven't seen it. So I thought,
Oh, God, it's Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS, isn't it?
That's from the 70s.
Might be a remake, I don't know.
No one is remaking that. It's a law everywhere. It's been adopted universally across the planet. No one will remake Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS.
Well, then I'm out of ideas. What is it?
Well, wake up, dead man.
You mean wake you up before you go-go?
No, I mean wake up, dead man, the third in the Knives Out mystery series. We did Glass Onion on this show. I can't remember if we did the first film, which was just Knives Out.
I don't think we did.
We did talk a lot about it during Glass Onion. We both liked Knives Out quite a bit.
Yeah. I love that. Had
differing opinions on Glass Onion, but I think you have seen it, but I have not yet seen Wake Up Dead Man, a Knives Out mystery, and I would like to see it, and I would like to talk about it. So next week, it's no mystery that we've chosen, or I've chosen, Wake Up Dead Man.
This has been a co-production of The Voice of Max and The Movie Wrench.